I read somebody said it's as hard to get into an ed school in Finland as it is to get into MIT.
That's Joel Klein. He knows a little bit about schools and education schools.
I was the CEO of Amplify, which is an education technology company started by News Corp. Before that, for a little over 8 years, I was the schools chancellor in New York City under Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Klein has rolled his education experience into a book called Lessons of Hope, How to Fix Our Schools. That bit he mentioned about ed schools in Finland, he was citing Amanda Ripley, who wrote a book called The Smartest Kids in the World and how they got that way.
To get into education college in Finland is like getting into MIT in the United States. And imagine what could follow if that were true here.
Imagine what could follow if that were true here.
They created a set of expectations, brought people into the field, and there's nothing like self-fulfilling prophecy.
But it's not that hard to get into an education school in the U.S., not that hard to become a school teacher. As a result, U.S. teachers are, well,
they're just a little bit below average.
That's Dana Goldstein. She has written a book called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession.
And that is unusual compared to a lot of the nations that we compare ourselves to, whether it's Japan or South Korea or Finland. You often hear in Finland, as a comparison, that the typical public school teacher graduated in the top 10% of their high school class.
We're taking more and more people from the bottom half or even the bottom third of their college graduating class, and that's always seemed to me to be a big mistake.
We've all heard the depressing numbers. When compared to kids from other rich countries, U.S. students are also a little bit below average, especially in math, even though we spend more money per student than most other countries. So, is the problem here as simple as adding 2 + 2 and getting 4? Is the problem here that our students aren't getting very bright in school simply because our teachers aren't very bright?
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Okay, let's start with a few caveats. When we say that U.S. students aren't doing very well and that U.S. teachers aren't the best and brightest, let's remember that we're talking about averages. There are, of course, millions of American kids who get a great education in public school. There are, of course, many, many excellent teachers. We should also know that just because a future teacher finishes near the top of their high school or college class doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be a great classroom teacher. In any case, the subject of teacher skill has taken over the education debate.
Teachers matter. So instead of bashing them or defending the status quo, let's offer schools a deal. Give them the resources to keep good teachers on the job and reward the best ones.
That's President Obama from his 2012 State of the Union speech. And this is John Friedman.
Our article was first posted online right at the beginning of January in 2012, which was actually 2 days after my first son was born.
Friedman is an economist who works on public policy at Brown University's Watson Institute. The article he's talking about is called The Long-Term Impacts of Teachers, Teacher Value Added, and Student Outcomes in Adulthood.
And our paper got a lot of attention, and I was juggling trying to help my wife care for a newborn and deal with various people who wanted to talk. And it was late one night, 9:45, we had put our son to bed, and I was running out to Babies R Us to pick up some diapers. And I flipped on the radio, and I heard the president on the State of the Union start to talk about education. And I said, well, you know, it's been getting a lot of attention. Maybe he'll mention it, maybe not, but, you know, probably not. And he just got closer and closer to the topic, and soon enough, there it was. $250,000 for a better teacher. Just said it right there. It was a pretty amazing day.
We know a good teacher can increase the lifetime income of a classroom by over $250,000. A great teacher can offer an escape from poverty, to the child who dreams beyond his circumstance. Every person in this chamber can point to a teacher who changed the trajectory of their lives.
You know, a lot of the time academics work to get their work published in academic journals or to get their work cited by their colleagues. And to see policy-relevant work being cited by the president, it just gave me a real great feeling that people out there were listening to what we were working on.
Not only were people listening, the paper that Friedman wrote, along with co-authors Raj Chetty and Jonah Rockoff, became the chief topic of conversation in the never-ending debate about education reform. Friedman himself wound up working for several months as a White House advisor. Here is the paper's central argument.
We find it useful to think about a really great teacher, a top 5% teacher, coming into a school and replacing a teacher who was average. Now, that substitution for just a single classroom will increase the future earnings of those students by nearly $1.5 million over the course of their careers. And of course, a lot of that money will come far in the future. So if you're worried about discounting, $1.5 million over their careers is the same thing as $250,000 deposited in the bank that same year to accrue interest and let the students consume more over their lives. But it's not just that students earn higher wages. We also see that they're more likely to go to college. They're more likely to not just get high-paying jobs, but high-quality jobs. They're more likely to live in high-quality neighborhoods. And even for female students, we see that they're less likely to have children as teenagers.
That doesn't sound exactly revolutionary, does it? A great teacher is better than an average teacher. And furthermore, the gains of great teaching amplify over the course of a student's lifetime. Joel Klein, the former New York City schools chancellor, also sees this.
Well, I have no doubt that what matters most is the teacher in the classroom. The K to 12, kindergarten to 12th grade system in America is a system that's driven by teachers and the quality of teaching, which affects not only the sort of content and knowledge that a child acquires, the skills a child develops, but really at a human level, the confidence, the maturation, and so forth. So at the top of the heap for me would always be teachers.
Teachers are the absolute most important people in our educational system.
That's Dave Levin. He's a former teacher and co-founder of the KIPP Schools. KIPP, K-I-P-P, it stands for Knowledge is Power program, began in 1994. It is now a national network of public schools generally regarded as very high performing.
And when you think about the most important people in a kid's life outside of their family, it starts with their teacher. I mean, for the obvious reason, right? You leave home, you go to school, and the teacher is the determinant of how that day goes. And even as the kids get older, when all the research says the peer effect is so essential, teachers have a huge impact on how peers interact in the classroom.
Okay, so if the teacher's role is so important, and if a great teacher is so much more effective than a not great teacher, the solution's pretty easy, isn't it? Find more great teachers, or maybe do a better job of preparing teachers to be great. And while we're at it, maybe we should also raise teacher salaries. We're going to talk about all those ideas as we move forward, but let's begin by going back to the beginning of the teaching profession in the United States.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that in 1800, teaching in a public school in front of, say, mixed gender groups of children was considered a job that was really only appropriate for men.
That's Dana Goldstein.
And that changed over the course of the 19th century.
And why was that at the time?
It was considered very public. You're very public, you're very out there, you're earning money in a public way, and you're in front of mixed gender groups.
So inappropriate
parents,
for...
Inappropriate.
Okay.
Inappropriate, especially for a middle-class white woman to do that type of work. And I write in the first chapter of the book about Catherine Beecher. She was Harriet Beecher Stowe's sister, and they came from this strong, socially committed abolitionist family. And the way she sort of conceived of teaching was that because women were natural-born mothers, they were biologically suited to spending time with children, that they would be wonderful teachers in the classroom as well. And she's interested in this because she decides that she's not going to get married and she would like to have something interesting to do with her life other than kind of be an old maid, which is this, you know, horrible 19th century stereotype of the single woman. So she would like single women to have a socially useful role in the young American democratic experiment in the early 19th century, and she conceives of public school teaching as the way to do that. And policymakers like Horace Mann, who's considered the founder of our public school system, this is very attractive to them.
On an economic level, yes?
Yes, for pragmatic reasons. Right. I mean, if you're going to make public schooling compulsory, which did not happen across all the states until the late 19th century, if you're going to do that, you need many more teachers. And, well, you can pay women 50% as much. So this feminine modesty, morality argument that
loses out to utilitarianism.
Catherine Beecher makes this argument, and then male politicians, they love this because it sounds really good, but it's also cheap.
I went to kindergarten through graduating from high school in public schools in Brooklyn and Queens.
Joel Klein again.
That was from 1951 through 1963.
When I think of those years in New York City, particularly, but in U.S. public education generally, I think of them as a kind of golden era. Was that a golden era of public school education?
On the one hand, we expected so much less from education in those days. And what I mean by that, it always struck me, when I started public school in New York City in 1951, Stephen, approximately 60% of America's workforce were high school dropouts. Today, that number is probably 5-6% and declining. So in some respects, what we expected from education was different. But I do think in other respects, it was a golden era in that during that period, certainly my experience, and I think nationally the experience, was that teachers, particularly women teachers, not having the kind of opportunities they have today, you would draw really high-quality people into the field. That's not an argument for denying women opportunities, but the beneficiary of the sexism that was taking place were very high-quality, talented women went to work.
This is the brain drain theory of U.S. teaching. It argues that as well-educated women started having the opportunity to become lawyers and doctors and engineers, the talent pool for teachers got shallower. And relative to those other professions, teaching became a relatively low-paying profession.
So the median income for the American public school teacher is about $54,000 per year. And actually, if you look at the median incomes for teachers in other nations, it's not that different. Mm-hmm. However, what economists have said about this is you can't just look at the salary itself. You have to look at the gaps between what college-educated workers in different fields make. So, for example, in the United States, the difference between what an attorney makes and what a teacher makes is much larger than the difference between the typical attorney and the typical teacher in Finland or South Korea, or the typical teacher and the typical engineer, a much smaller difference in South Korea than the United States.
So in general, KIPP teachers will be making more. I mean, they're working longer hours, so they're making more money for that time.
That's Dave Levin from KIPP.
And as a society, you know, we have to start thinking, yes, we have to start paying teachers more and recognizing there will be professions that pay more. What else can we do to make teaching as respected a profession as possible? I mean, and, you know, one of my favorite ideas is for teachers who continue to teach past their fifth year, that we consider some type of tax break and tax incentive for them, including the possibility that they don't pay income tax. Recognizing that we won't always be able to pay teachers more, but there are ways that we can say to teachers, hey, you are a national treasure. You are essential to the future of the country. And I think if we got serious about that, it could really make a huge difference. Even little things like, you know, I know it sounds little, but, you know, we have armed forces board airplanes first. Well, why not have armed forces and teachers board airplanes first? You know, I just think there are lots of ways we could think about valuing the teaching profession more.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, let's not pretend that boosting teachers' salaries would automatically fix everything.
So I think, yes, the way we train teachers is fundamentally broken in this country.
And is it really fair to blame only the teachers?
I mean, we often used to jokingly say, you know, parents give us the best kids that they have for us to educate, and by the same token, kids come with the best parents they're going to get, and we have to take them where they are.
That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio. And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We've been talking about teacher skill in the U.S. and how important that is.
If you look back through all the different education reforms we've tried in American history, they've almost always been motivated by our fears of the worst teachers.
That's Dana Goldstein, author of The Teacher Wars.
So we start from the assumption that our teachers are failing, and we know they're often not doing as well as we want them to. And then we decide we would like to get them out, so find ways to weaken their job security to get them out of the classroom, and also to bring a new cadre of teachers in who are going to do better. And what I found is that this pair of solutions, driving people out, bringing new people in, it's not enough because the demand for teachers is so high. We do need 100,000 new teachers every year to satisfy the labor market. So what I suggest is instead of starting with our fear of bad teaching, we look at teachers who are excellent at what they do right here in the United States, and we ask about how to create systems where we can replicate their best practices.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a tremendous number of like amazing teachers everywhere in the country.
That's Dave Levin from the KIPP schools.
And, you know, the success of KIPP from the beginning has been able to recruit them to come work with us, to help them grow and become even better, and then to have them stay.
Talk to me for just a minute about how teaching is taught generally in the country. I'd especially like it if you could talk about it in light of the kind of common thought experiment. I'm sure you've heard it, you know, if you went to sleep 120, 130 years ago and woke up today, almost everything in the world would have changed except for the classroom where there's one teacher up in front of 20 or 30 kids with a chalkboard and so on.
So I think, yes, the way we train teachers is fundamentally broken in this country. And I think that's true on three levels. So one, it's disproportionately theory-based. It's just, I'm not sure of like what good the theory of math instruction is if you don't actually know how to deliver a lesson on math as well. Number two, we have two problems with the way we approach content in this country. There is no doubt that content is queen and king. So the importance of content mastery in the classroom is absolutely essential. Having said that, sometimes the best math teachers weren't necessarily the best math students because, you know, you often teach better what you weren't so good at because you actually had to work to learn it. And yet, very often you have to have a certain number of college credits in math in order to be a math teacher. There is truth to that for sure when you get to the more complicated and higher levels. At K-8 level, however, you need to be able to deliver the content. You need to have a mastery over that. And that isn't necessarily meaning you had a math degree in order to be able to teach fractions. You just need to be able to actually understand the nuances behind fractions. And right now, we're assuming that if you have a math degree, you can teach math as opposed to, you know, being taught the content. Now, the third problem with the way teachers are trained is that we are not training teachers right now to meet the challenges of our kids today, right? So we're not teaching teachers well enough how to effectively differentiate for the vast range of skills that kids have. We're not teaching teachers effectively enough how to use technology to further teaching. And we're not teaching teachers how to make school relevant for what kids are really needing to succeed in the colleges they may go to or the careers they may pursue, you know, 20 years from now.
So when you say that the way we teach teachers is fundamentally broken, and then you describe these dimensions on which it's not working, I guess my next question is a very obvious one, which is why? I mean, you know, in most areas of higher ed, the curriculum and methodology and pedagogy adapts over time. I mean, the way computer science is taught now is really different than it was taught 30 years ago. And the failings that you describe, they sound maybe hard to address, but not complicated. So why hasn't the teaching of teachers evolved? Yeah.
So why is that? I mean, I think there are a couple of reasons. It has been historically very, very hard to evaluate and remove ineffective teachers. How you're trained and your future performance have been very, very disconnected. Now, there's been a big push recently around teacher evaluation and teacher accountability, but people still aren't really connecting the entire cycle between the recruiting, developing, and retaining of teachers.
And that's why Levin decided to help start a new kind of graduate school to educate teachers.
The Relay Graduate School of Education, I was one of the co-founders along with Norman Atkins and Daisha Toll. Norman Atkins from Uncommon Schools and Daisha Toll from Achievement First. And we basically felt that there was a disconnect between the way our teachers were getting trained in the graduate schools around New York City and New Jersey and Connecticut and their performance in the classroom. And so what we thought is that you could create a more productive union between theory and practice, and that you could have people who are teaching teachers who are still connected to students, either as teachers or as principals. And what started in New York has now grown to New Jersey and New Orleans and Houston. It is a 2 years master's program where the enrolled teachers need to show student proficiency in order to earn their master's.
Give me some specifics on that, Dave. What kind of proficiency do they need to show, and how does it differ from the standard ed school?
So in the standard ed school, there you don't need to show any proficiency by and large. Your master's defense might include writing a paper or delivering a project. Now, this is actually changing in real time. So there are places now where to get a master's, you do need to start demonstrating the applicability of that in a classroom. But for us, it is a variety of measures that teachers can use. So some of it, if you teach third through eighth grade in New York, for example, you can use the state test and you can use your value added to demonstrate that kids have made a year's worth of progress. If you teach K-2, you could use the STEP assessment or Fontes and Pinnell. But either way, there has to be some demonstrable way that you've shown student growth. And for folks who teach other subjects such as the humanities or the sciences, part of what they do is they outline how they're going to show that growth at the beginning of their second year, and then that progress is measured. And that doesn't, you know, how is that different? The very existence is the difference.
The role of education schools also came up when I asked Joel Klein, the former New York schools chancellor, about building a better teacher.
They've got to have demanding criteria. They've got to support rigorous entry requirements into the profession, whether it's the equivalent of some form of national exam or state-by-state exam, but that really tests people on the range of skills and talents they need.
But Klein sees other flaws in the teacher system besides the ed schools.
We then got to move away from a trade union model, which is built on these three pillars of life, tenure, seniority, and lockstep pay, toward a professional model that rewards excellence and supports greatness. And the third thing I would say, Stephen, in terms of a solution, and this kind of maybe is a good tie with my old antitrust days, and that is, I think the more choices we give families, the better it's going to be, whether those are charter school choices or traditional public school choices. And what I mean by that is, everybody that you know, and I suspect most people listening today, have exercised choice of schools for their kids. They've moved to a neighborhood if they want to live there where it's a good public school. Some of them have gone to private schools. The kids with the least resources in America are the kids who are not getting any choices. It's one and done for them. And it seems to me if we could create the kind of choices you now see, for example, in Harlem, which we created under Mayor Bloomberg's leadership, where now basically there are lots and lots of options, and parents have increasingly become informed consumers.
Those old antitrust days that Klein mentioned? He used to work for the Department of Justice. He was the lead prosecutor in United States versus Microsoft Corporation. Now, Bill Gates was not very fond of you at the time, was he?
I think that's fair to say.
you were not on his Christmas card list at the time.
Not on his Christmas card list, and not a lot of invites to Seattle, Washington to meet with him.
And you guys, however, did kiss and make up at some point?
Well, Bill gets all the credit for it. Before I started as chancellor in New York, he had given a $10 million philanthropic contribution to help establish new small high schools for highly dysfunctional large high schools in high poverty communities. And the question was whether he would stick in after I was appointed. And thankfully he did and became the largest contributor to New York City schools in terms of literally well over $100 million over the course of my tenure, a lot of which went into this new small schools initiative, which were breaking down these large failing schools in high poverty communities that have 2,000-3,000 kids, replacing them with 4, 5, 6 smaller schools with a lot of community support and partnerships and much more demanding requirements. And the results of that have been just phenomenal.
Did you ever talk to him what it was like for him to learn that, you know, here he was with the Gates Foundation giving money to a lot of different schools and school systems, including New York, and then to find out that you, his bete noire, was the guy who was coming in to run the New York City schools? Did you have that conversation with him ever?
I never did. I was just so grateful that he was willing to support us. The jury was out on this, and then we had an event. I'll never forget this event because I hadn't seen or spoken to Bill since after the case. This was about a 3-year hiatus, and he came to the Bronx to a school, Morris High School up there, where we were opening these new small schools. And he and I spent the day together. I didn't know what it would be like, and it was a very warm, engaging day. We went to classrooms together, and then we did a public appearance with Mayor Bloomberg. And in it, Bill made some glancing jokes about the antitrust suit and so forth, and happy to be on the same team. And when it was all finished, I just was so relieved that it had gone so well. And as I walked off the podium, a principal came up to me and said, "You know, Chancellor," said, "Bill Gates gave you $51 million today. That's a nice day's work." He said, "But just think of it."
But let's be honest. All the Gates Foundation grants in the world, all the school reform and teacher reform in the world, won't necessarily solve the problem. There is a mountain of recent evidence suggesting, in fact, that teacher skill has less influence on a student's performance than a completely different set of factors, like how much kids have learned from their parents, how hard they work at home, and whether the parents have instilled an appetite for education. In other words, you can reform the supply side of the school's equation all you want. What about the demand side? Students and their families.
If you come from a family that inspires a kid to learn, that's demanding about a child's homework, that's enormously helpful and valuable. But I always like to hold those things somewhat constant because the people in the education business are not going to be able to change those things. I mean, we often used to jokingly say, you know, parents give us the best kids that they have for us to educate, and by the same token, kids come with the best parents they're going to get, and we have to take them where they are.
Think about it. A school has your kid for only 7 hours a day, 180 days a year, or about 22% of the kid's waking hours. Nor is all that time devoted to learning, once you account for socializing and eating and getting to and from class. And for many kids, the first 3 or 4 years of life is all parents and no school. But when serious people talk about education reform, they rarely talk about the family's role in preparing children to succeed. Rarely, but not never.
My name is Carolyn Acker. I was the executive director of the Regent Park Community Health Center.
Regent Park in downtown Toronto is known for having one of Canada's oldest, biggest, and worst housing projects.
So we're doing all this work. We're investing more and more dollars. When I went to Regent Park Community Health Center in 1992, the budget was about $2.8 million. By about 1996, 97, the budget was close to $6 million. Instead of things improving, things were getting worse in terms of crime and murder and violence, this kind of thing. We were very distressed over what was happening to our young people, and we didn't really understand it. We were doing more and more, always investing more, and we weren't seeing an improvement. There were about 9 murders in Regent Park in 2000, which was the year before we started Pathways to Education.
Pathways to Education was a voluntary program for high school kids in Regent Park. It wasn't an education program exactly. It was more like life support.
The Pathways program, they say, has 4 pillars. Those are counseling, academic, social, and financial.
That's Philip Oriopoulos. He's an economist at the University of Toronto with a particular interest in education. Over the years, Oriopoulos had heard about Pathways to Education, that it was something of a miracle cure for low-performing high schoolers. He wondered if that could possibly be true.
Pathways to Education had a pro bono study done in the mid-2000s by a consulting firm. And the director that did the pro bono study was a member of the board of Pathways and came out with a report.
I can feel your antenna as an empirical economist already going up, right? A nice report done by a consultant. This was Boston Consulting Group, I believe, right?
It was a Boston Consulting Group. And
who are good and reputable, but still a pro bono report commissioned by someone who's also sitting on the board of the nonprofit that's running the thing, you might be a little bit skeptical, yes?
Well, what was striking about the report was it suggested that before Pathways, the dropout rate was 56%, and very soon after Pathways was introduced, the dropout rate was 10%. So you had a 46 percentage point fall in the dropout rate, and the report was attributing it to the introduction of Pathways. And this type of magnitude and effect is virtually unheard of in the education literature. It's like the holy grail of programs that try to improve outcomes, especially among disadvantaged households. And if these results were true, we should try to figure out exactly how to replicate them across the country and in the U.S. because they're so large, it would solve a lot of our problems.
So, were the results true? If so, how did it happen? And most important, where did the rest of us sign up? To find out, let's go back to when Carolyn Acker was running a community health center in a Toronto housing project.
I was driven to break the cycle of poverty. How do you break the cycle of poverty? Well, education and income are the two most powerful determinants of health.
So here's the paradox. The returns to education are huge, but the kind of kid who really needs those big returns, a kid from a poor, maybe broken family, is least likely to get a good education. As much as the school system might want to help, they're not really set up for it. So what about a community health center and a housing project? It wasn't an obvious idea, in the beginning at least, even to Carolyn Acker.
And the community had quite a stigma, and it was sensationalized and made a lot of headlines, right? Regent Park is this horrible place, and look what's happening there. Now, we never felt that way. We felt a privilege to be able to serve the community and very distressed by the fact that we were working harder and expending more efforts and investment to improve the health of the community, and we weren't seeing it improve at all.
They kept trying new things.
And we were doing our third or fourth strategic plan.
Finally, they couldn't help but notice the relationship between school and all the bad stuff happening in Regent Park.
So we worked with the Toronto District School Board They told us we had a 56% high school dropout rate and that only 20% of the kids were going on to post-secondary. And when the director of the program came and told me that, I said, now I know why these kids are shooting each other. They have no hope and no future.
Acker and her colleagues changed their focus. Rather than dwelling on all the bad outcomes in their neighborhood, what about the good outcomes, as rare as they might be?
And we brought in focus groups. We did the young people who grew up in Regent Park, who had made it through university, were doing well. We asked them what made the difference in their lives. And every one of those people told us somebody took them under their wing. It was either a teacher, it was either a parks and recreation person, and they taught them and they helped them all the way. Now, this only happened to a handful of people spontaneously, but we were listening. Listening is exceptionally important. And we determined they lack academic support. There is absolutely no one they can go to for help with homework. They lack social capital. They have no networks whatsoever. They go from one house of poverty to another. There's no aunt or uncle who can help them get a job. So I was thinking, I have to make an old boys network here.
And she and her staff came up with basically the Pathways to Education model.
That's Philip Oriopoulos, the University of Toronto economist.
With the idea and the motivation being that if they could break the cycle by reducing the dropout rates and encouraging individuals within the community to go on to doing well in their careers and then give back to the community that they came from, that would be a way to try to turn the community around.
Pathways to Education would be a voluntary program funded primarily by the government and nonprofits. All you had to do to qualify was be a high school kid in the neighborhood and sign a contract along with a parent that you'll do everything you're supposed to do. In 2001, when Pathways began, 115 incoming freshmen signed up. Every year, a new cohort was added. Within a few years, more than 600 kids were participating. And the program spread to two other housing projects in Toronto. The take-up rate was about 85%.
It's unique in that the origins of the program are neighborhood-based. It's not directly, explicitly tied to the schools, and yet they coordinate a lot with the schools. The neighborhood source is important because it helps give the students a sense of community, even away from the school, that they're part of this group on or off the school grounds, and that it's the community really paying attention to them.
That's what Carolyn Acker means by Old Boys Network. To get Regent Park kids to go to school, to do well in school, it would take more than just one or two lines of intervention. In fact, it took four: counseling, academic tutoring, social activities, and financial incentives.
On the counseling side, every student that enters grade 9 gets assigned a student parent support worker, and they call them SPSWs. The SPSWs are paid advocates who meet on a regular basis with the student to check in with how they're doing, and it's their job and role to help ensure the academic success of the student. The next pillar is on the academic side, where tutoring services are available up to four nights a week. Students have to visit their SPSW twice a month, and they're expected to attend tutoring services twice a week, unless if their grades are above a certain amount, around 70%. And as incentives to do those things, there's the financial pillar. So as long as a student continues to participate in all the activities and pathways, they're eligible to receive free public transportation that can get them to school and back, and also a college scholarship that builds up to $4,000 by the end of high school.
$4,000 for each year of college or total?
Total.
So financial incentives, but let's be honest, not huge. Free transportation, certainly not huge, but something, and then $4,000 for...
And yet, when interviewing the students participating in Pathways, it's clear that the public transportation is a big deal to them, that they feel that they have to participate in order to get the public transportation tickets, or else that they would be walking to school.
We have a contract, parents sign it, because we need a permission to look at the grades, look at the marks, so that when a parent called up and said, you didn't give my Johnny enough bus tickets, we would say, well, Johnny skipped school on Wednesday. That's why he didn't get two for that day. Oh, he did he? The kids told me they would get the bus tickets and they'd sell them for cigarettes only the first time, because they would learn right away, now they can't get to school.
And then the last pillar is the social pillar, where Pathway students are eligible and required to go to at least one group activity a month. And these group activities are designed, one, to keep them out of trouble and encourage them to hang out with also academically interested students, and two, to have fun or even learn something along the way.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we'll learn just how effective Pathways to Education was and, what we really want to know, of all those different interventions, which ones were doing the heavy lifting?
I think it's virtually impossible to even imagine setting up the ideal experiment to investigate that.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Philip Oriopoulos had heard that Pathways to Education was phenomenally successful at helping kids stay in school and do well. But the source of this rumor was a report that had been commissioned by a Pathways board member. Oriopoulos, as a research academic, wanted to look at the data for himself.
Right. So I started engaging Pathways on possibly working with their data a while back. It took me a few years to convince them that I was genuinely trying to evaluate the program and look in the program from a nonpartisan perspective. And I think, to their credit, that they were also interested in having a third party evaluate the program.
Oriopoulos was able to get hold of some publicly available data, but it was when Pathways started feeding him their data that he could really measure what was going on.
Just prior to the introduction of the Pathways program in 2001, the entering grade 9 students in 2000, the eventual graduation rate, 5-year graduation rate for them was 40%. And 2 years later, it does jump up quite a bit to almost 60%. So a 20 percentage point increase in the graduation rate for students who were entering from Regent Park. And keep in mind, the program was phased in starting from grade 9s entering in 2001. So grade 10s in 2001 were not eligible, but grade 9s were. And then all the grade 9s entering afterwards were eligible for Pathways. And so you compare that to the change in the graduation rates for the students from other housing projects, the increase in graduation was less than 5 percentage points. So you had a 20 percentage point increase over a 2-year period for students from Regent Park, and then you had only a 3 or 4 percentage point change in the other projects. So the estimated impact of the program was about a 15 to 16 percentage point increase in the high school graduation rate.
Which is huge, yeah?
It's huge. It's not the large effect that the Boston consulting firm was finding, but still, it's a large enough effect to get really excited about. So not only do I find large increases in the high school graduation, but also about a 20 percentage point increase in college going as well.
So one would think that educators and politicians around the world are looking at this as a beacon of light and saying, hey, let's replicate, or adjust to our own needs. Is that the case or no?
Well, sometimes I describe the Pathways program to people outside of Canada as the Harlem Children's Zone of Canada. We have this interesting program that's relatively young that people are becoming more aware of, that seems to be successful, at least in the settings that have been so far examined. I think the program is certainly intriguing to want to consider possible expansion both in Canada and in the US. I think overall, there is some effort to try to disentangle what parts of the program or what are the key ingredients that are really driving these positive impacts, and taking from that knowledge ways to expand the program.
Philip, in the paper, you with your co-authors write, it is not possible to tell from the results in this paper whether only a few components of the program drive the results or whether its integration is crucial. So can you talk to me about that for a minute? Why you can't tell which of these different interventions are the ones that are moving the needle and which of these perhaps you suspect are driving the gains?
Because the analysis simply looks at what happens to these graduation rates or college-going rates before and after the program compared to some comparison groups, the main estimated effects are on the overall impact of the program, what happened when the program was introduced. But of course, that doesn't really say, even with these large impacts, what's driving that, whether it's just one component or one pillar of the program, or whether it's really important that all the services are provided at the same time. I think it's virtually impossible to even imagine setting up the ideal experiment to investigate that. The title of my paper is An Integrated Approach for Helping Disadvantaged Youth. Integrated because I think it may well be that a student who goes to see his SPSW gets advised to make sure that they're going to tutoring. And while they're going to tutoring, they meet some friends or students, and then they get encouraged to go to the group activity. And then they keep doing this because they want the incentive. So everything is sort of working together to help ensure the participation.
Philip, you write that the cost of this program is nearly $5,000 per student per year. This, of course, is on top of the costs already going to the public school through taxes and so on. And that doesn't include pro bono tutoring and so on. So in some places, you know, $5,000 a year on top of all those other things that are not counted in a dollar fashion here, that buys a kid a good private school education. So considering the cost of this program per head, what can you tell us about overall ROI? So you've said that you found that Pathways to Education really increases high school completion and post-secondary enrollment a lot. But as large as those gains seem, you know, first of all, it's relatively expensive. And second of all, it's still barely half of these kids are finishing high school even so and or going to college.
If the impact that we're finding from Pathways is really correct in terms of a 15 percentage point increase in the high school graduation rate, a 20 percentage point increase in the college going rate, if these translate to higher earnings, say 10% a year or 15% a year, and possible non-pecuniary benefits as well, better health, lower crime rates, more social participation, these benefits are huge because they're added up over a lifetime, whereas the cost of Pathways is, you know, only for a 4-year, 5-year period. The potential impact from, you know, just a small increase in rate of return from these would lead to an increase in lifetime wealth that is likely to be quite substantially more than the $20,000 total cost of the program. And in fact, with some back-of-the-envelope estimates, I find that the tax revenue alone from the higher earnings is enough to cover the present value of the program.
Philip Oriopoulos wanted to measure the efficacy of Pathways to Education not only because he's an economist who pays attention to education, but because he thinks that most economists who pay attention to education are missing the point.
For the longest time, economics has modeled education as a well-thought-out investment. And so all decisions are the right ones. If a student decides that he or she doesn't want to study or she wants to drop out of high school, our traditional models say that that's the right thing to do, that they're doing the best that they can under their circumstances and their ability and whatnot. And more recently, economics has started incorporating elements of psychology and sociology and neuroscience to recognize that we don't always get it right when thinking about long-term investment decisions, especially when it has to do with ourselves and these kind of things.
In one of your papers, you make the point that young people, while needing education to do well later, are kind of the worst candidates for understanding how much they need education to do well later. And you open with a quote from Aristotle, which I never read, which I love. The roots of education are bitter, but the fruit is sweet.
Right. My father always mentioned that quote when I was a kid to remind me that however bitter the experience of education is right now, the effort from staying home on a Friday night or, you know, doing something that doesn't really seem that exciting or fun and requiring concentration and thinking, however tedious, the benefits are long-term and they're big. And the difficulty making these types of decisions is especially true for children and adolescents whose brains are just not even developed at that point, when the cortex and the parts of the brain that are really focused on trying to imagine the future and think about the consequences are taking many years to develop.
Is this, do you think, a problem that we're only starting to realize now? Or is this something, you know, look, Aristotle knew it. Did we forget it for a few thousand years and we're just getting back to it? Or is it something that you think education folks and ed reform people have known all along?
I think we're starting to pay more attention to the possibility that a more behavioral model might be a better way of describing how individuals are making schooling decisions. And that opens up to a lot of possibilities for policies. So on the one hand, students may not be getting it always right. That's not to say that they always get it wrong. But on the other hand, there's room with this knowledge to come in and think about alternative ways to help them that we haven't thought about before.
So if you think of education as a form of investing, and as we know, when it comes to financial investing, there are all kinds of mistakes to be made. What kind of mistakes do students make in thinking about education?
I guess I boil it down to 4 points. One is students are often too focused on the present. They de-emphasize the future. They don't think about it as much as they should. The second is that students tend to over-rely on routine, just keep doing what they've been doing and not realizing maybe other routines might be better for them. 3 is that students sometimes think too much about negative identities. They focus on what they're not good at, or they might hang out with the wrong crowd and be influenced negatively in that way. And the 4th one is that mistakes are more likely in stressful situations or in situations where there's not enough information.
Right. So when you talk about that integration and you talk about all the different components of it, there's the social worker that's attached to the student and the parents, there's the academic tutoring, there's the financial incentives, there's the group activities and the social pillar. When you describe it like that, and when I read about the program itself, it strikes me that basically this program is performing the function of a community and the family within the community. So I'm just curious. I know it's attractive because it works well and because it's relatively unusual, but did it strike you at any point that, holy cow, what this program is doing is essentially backfilling for what society and families used to already be doing on their own without a special program designed to achieve it?
It's possible. It's possible that the program is succeeding because there's not enough support at home or in other parts of the community. I think all households, to some degree or other, sometimes miss out on providing that, you know, encouragement or that nudge towards using services that students themselves may not feel that they want to use. I think one interesting possibility is that the program is working essentially by mandating that a student see someone on a regular basis to talk about their academic goals, to get reminded about why they're in school or where they're going, and to get mandated to use tutoring services even if they don't really feel that they have time or that they don't need the help.
Carolyn Acker, who helped set up Pathways to Education, was instrumental in making the tutoring mandatory. And she's not even a behavioral economist. Nope. Her background was nursing. Maybe that's where she learned to listen so well.
The kids actually told us to make tutoring mandatory. After our first year, which we called a pilot year, we brought in the youth, we did focus groups with the tutors, the mentor, how do we improve this? And we asked the young people, how do we increase attendance at tutoring? And the naughtiest boys of all looked at us and said, you have to make it mandatory. So you see, the young people want structure, and they want to know that somebody's caring about them. We care if you skip school.
I'm Stephen Dubner. That's our show. Thanks for listening. And remember, wherever you are and whenever you'd like, you can listen to our Freakonomics Radio podcast. You can get it at Freakonomics.com or iTunes, where you can also subscribe. Thanks.